Prelude.
Odense, May 1945. Vengeance. At least I witnessed the euphoria of Liberation Day. First, the words broadcast on the BBC Evening News. Here is London. A brief silence, then shouts of joy. A feeling the city came alive in the moment darkness fell over our rooftops. Just like everyone else, I ran out onto the streets. We all wanted to see our neighbours, share this moment with them, burn the blackout curtains we loathed. Bonfires blazed and the curtains curled and died in the flames. It was as if a plague, a deadly epidemic, had finally eased its stranglehold. We knew it would happen, of course, that the day that proved to be a night would come. It was windy. The air was cool, but we were warmed by an immense joy shared with our fellow men. And it extended into the following day, the official Liberation Day after German occupation of Denmark. Grey clouds hung over the emancipated land. It was raining, but nothing could prevent our celebrations. How were we to know this Saturday would prove to be the bloodiest of the occupation? As the war ended elsewhere in Europe, it broke out in Odense. Throughout the city, battles between the Danish resistance and German soldiers raged. Gunfire and explosions erupted in the streets. No one understood why, and the consequences were gruesome. Multiple dead and wounded. Men, women, and children. The casualty and operating theatres were on red alert. Odense Hospital had called every available staff member to duty. My team alone performed 6 major operations that day. Internal bleeding, broken bones, amputation of a shattered limb. For an extended period, the regular routine of the surgical ward was fraught in panic. People were yelling instructions at one another, and there were bloody footprints in the grey linoleum corridors. It felt as if I had been catapulted into a field hospital in a war zone. Suspended in turmoil, everything felt unreal, like the narrative of a grotesque novel. We struggled to maintain an overview. Maintain an effective sequence in our surgical procedures, prioritize the most critical patients, and acknowledge the fact when it was clear nothing more could be done. Many of the people wounded that day had lost so much blood that they were declared dead on arrival. Others died on the operating table. Most were adults, but not all. It was late in the afternoon when 2 ambulance men rushed in with a severely injured patient. They had done what they could to stop the massive bleeding. But the injuries were severe, and the patient was in hypovolemic shock because he had lost more than half his bodily blood supply. When the ambulance men reached our operating theatre and stopped to catch their breath on the corridor, one of my colleagues rushed to the door to assist, and I walked after her as fast as I could. As a rule, we never ran on our ward. My colleague bent over the gurney, and as she turned the patient's head towards her, her own face crumbled, and I knew she wasn't in any state to help. This would only make matters worse. Sobbing openly, my colleague tried to utter something, but I wasn't listening. I pushed her aside and looked into the face of the patient. It was just a boy, about 10 years old. Without expecting to find one, I felt the boy's neck for a pulse. It was 150, much too fast, and his skin was cold to the touch. I looked at his face, dirty, blood-smeared, a crust around the mouth. Eyes almost closed. Had it not been for the tachycardic heart rhythm, I would have taken him for dead on arrival. At that moment, there had been a lull in the otherwise constant stream of incoming patients, and the ambulance men helped us get the boy into the operating theatre. We only had time for the bare essential sterilization of operating tools. The going was slippery. The blood clung to the rubber soles of my clogs, but no one had time to mop the floor. The boy's left arm had severe lesions that were bleeding profusely, and the tendons and arteries were exposed. One of my colleagues cut off what remained of the boy's clothing while I clamped the arteries in his arm and called for a blood transfusion. Instruments rattled in their sterile, stainless steel bowls. The chief surgeon came, his sterilized hands raised in the air, and we got to work. Later, I read the boy's name in the newspapers. Franz. He was 10 years old.